of your homeworld, Usul.
Now I actually get that reference.
You're listening to the Metamore City Podcast. Metamore City, a podcast series created by Chris Lester. For more information, please visit www.metamorphcity.com.
Hey Metamorphs, welcome to the Metamore City Season 1 Exit Interview. I'm Steve Rickyberg, and you can find me over on GeekCred at geekcred.net, where I'm usually doing in-depth interviews to bring you the inside scoop on everything geek, from tech to sci-fi to games. But today, I'm not here for GeekCred. Here, we are recording this live on TalkShoe, and with the end of Making the Cut, bringing Metamore City Season 1 to an end, I will, of course, be talking to author Chris Lester and take a look back at this experience. So how are you doing today, Chris?
I'm doing really well, Steve. We had some technical difficulties getting started here, but feeling good. We're getting close to the end of the semester, and so I'm looking forward to wrapping up this first year as a teacher and getting into my writer's retreat for the summer, in which I'm going to be writing the next novel. And here in the studio with me, I have the inimitable J. Daniel Sawyer, author of The Antithesis Progression.
Hello.
Hey there.
He will be chiming in from time to time as my onboard peanut gallery.
So we will be taking some questions from all of you in the audience listening live. So if you have something to say, be sure to dial in if you aren't already and hit request to talk to get in the queue, or bring your questions in the chat room when the time comes. But first, I'd like to kick things off by taking a look back. Chris, you've been at this for a while, to say the least, Metamore City Season 1. So what's the feeling to finally have put this thing to bed?
Oh, it is a feeling of triumph. I did not know when I got started with this thing whether it was going to be too weird for people or not, because let's face it, we get into some pretty weird territory.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's thank you, Pip. Almost as I've been here in this game almost as long as CG Holyfield.
Almost.
It feels really satisfying to know that the podcast found an audience. Back in September 2007, I was thinking that if I got a few hundred listeners, that was going to be a major improvement over what I'd gotten through distributing my stories over internet mailing lists. And now here we are with 2,500 listeners, roughly speaking. And, we're not in Merlafferty territory yet, but I'm pretty darn proud of what we've accomplished.
Pip says, I love a man with stamina, but PG is taking it a little too far.
Yeah, Pip. PG started, 6 months before I did, and he still hasn't finished his first novel? Really, PG. I mean, if you're going to be a nemesis, you've got to kind of keep up.
Read more of Masters and Johnson than just the chapter on Plateau.
That's harsh. See, for all you guys on the podcast, this is why you got to be listening live, because you're missing all the crazy antics in the chat room.
Exactly. It really is.
Throw some Jell-O into this fight, and things could get interesting, says Pip.
So before this thing gets too off track, going back to the beginning, Chris. So you've been building this detailed world, and like you said, online like that. What prompted the idea to start podcasting and really begin this journey?
What prompted it was that I absolutely fell in love with the medium, and in particular with the collective nature of the... Basically, the fact that it was like joining a community. It is joining a community.
Definitely.
That I was just throwing these stories out into the void before, and maybe once a year I'd get a comment on my website from somebody who saw one and liked it enough that they wanted to let me know. But the mailing list that I had been a part of was kind of veering off from stuff that I was interested in, or perhaps my interests were just growing and moving beyond the focus of the mailing list. And so, yeah, I wanted to open it up to a larger audience, and more importantly than that, I wanted to open it up to people who I knew could give me feedback quickly on whether or not this story universe was actually something that was worth pursuing. And, sorry, you can't be there, Pip, at Balticon.
I can't be there either, Pip. We will have to mourn together.
But yes, one of these days. This really is a tribe, and it's just been an incredible honor and privilege to get to know everybody in the podcasting scene, and as well as all of the listeners who have become an active part of my life by engaging in these stories and responding to them.
So you've decided to start podcasting. Why? What was behind the decision to go more the full cast approach versus a straight read audiobook?
Well, for that, I have to give total props to the Uber nemesis, T. Morris. The fact that he demonstrated that you could create a story world that was immersive, that caught people up in the whole mise en scène of the book. You know, he recreated 1920s Chicago with his Bill Above Batting's book, and just with all of the voice cast and stuff, really made it come alive in a way that I had not seen done with audio fiction before in an amateur production. I had seen it done with Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials, and so that was probably where the seeds started getting planted, because that was a full cast audiobook. But that series did not include the full music and sound effects like Billy Batting's had.
Yeah.
So that was the thing that really persuaded me that this was something that not only could be done, but that it could be done on an amateur's budget.
It really blurred the line between an audiobook and an audio drama.
Particularly with having the first-person narration.
Absolutely.
And Pip is saying, "Oh, I was told this would be a tea-free podcast." Humph. And alas, Pip, I have iced tea here, so at least you can be sure he's not going to get so hot that he blows his top.
So what has been the most challenging part of doing this, of this journey, really, and as far as production and making this a reality?
I think the most challenging thing has been keeping up with a regular, consistent production schedule while trying to have a life. They don't tell you, well, they do tell you when you go into teaching that you're going to absolutely have to work your ass off and that you are going to want to kill yourself or kill someone else at multiple times during your first year. And so that was, I was unprepared really for the extent to which the job was going to consume my life. So that was a big challenge, definitely. Once I moved from Michigan and from my 9-to-5 desk job out to here, where I've got to deal with lesson planning and grading and all the stuff that I have to do for my internship program, that really took up a lot of my time. And the other thing was that once I met Dan and Kitty and they started pulling me into their social circle, I actually started having a life. And, you know, having places to be on Friday nights and, you know, being able to just get to know people who were interesting and fun. And I mean, I had a couple of really close friends back in Michigan, Brian and Sarah, both of whom are on the podcast.
And who you dedicated the book to.
Who I dedicated the book to. But, you know, I would see them, you know, maybe a couple times a week, which still left ample time for me to work in the evenings on the podcast or on the novel. And so, yeah, it's a big adjustment going from that to the kind of all-consuming thing that teaching is. And I honestly couldn't have done it without Paulette Jackson and Scott Roche, who helped me with the more drudgery-type aspects of podcast production that I could focus on the creative elements. Mm-hmm. So I just
you certainly didn't make it easy on yourself. You didn't make it easy by choosing that full cast approach.
Right.
Anything's
yeah,
a lot
I mean,
more
I,
complex.
I definitely didn't make my job any easier on myself that way. But I wouldn't choose to do it any other way. This is such a unusual world setting that I think that it needs that sort of immersive experience in order for people to really get it.
Yeah, yeah. And there is something very special about audio compared to, you know, text, and having those actors just enhances it that much more.
Yeah, definitely. I grew up listening to my mom reading stories to me. And so the spoken word has a very powerful place in my life, particularly in the world of storytelling. My brother and I would sit and listen to her read the Chronicles of Narnia and The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings and the Redwall series, and just getting caught up in those worlds and hearing someone else telling the story, hearing fiction being read and being read well. That was something that has been a part of my life since I was very young, and it's always been something that captured my imagination. It's still my favorite way to absorb a story, is to have someone tell it to me.
The opinion on the chat room seems to agree with you. Everyone is gushing about the full cast presentation and how much life it brought to the story.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad that you guys appreciated that. That's cool. Where is Paulette? Paulette Jackson. I'm not sure why she's not here today. Maybe she's, last I heard, she and Paul Fisher had gotten together earlier today because they called me to pass on some information about VaultaCon.
Oh, cool.
So they're probably in con prep right now.
I'm sure that.
Yeah, I can't imagine making the cut without a full cast either. That's Guest 7 posted that comment. And with like 30 different characters in the story, I don't think I could have done it, especially since you have like 11 or 12 of them in one place at one time in chapter one.
Yeah.
Such an ensemble cast, it would be very difficult, to say the least, reading it by yourself.
Mm-hmm. And I've got to also get props to my actors, because when you give a character to someone else to embody, it becomes not just one person's vision of the character, but then that vision of the writer is filtered through the perceptions and the performance of the actor, who can add all sorts of other layers to the performance and may see things in the character or in the text that they can bring out and bring to life in a way that you didn't necessarily envision as the writer. And that's a really cool experience. So.
Guest 12 says in the chat room, and nobody does a female voice like Sigler. Thank God.
Indeed.
were you giving your actors a lot of direction, especially for the remote ones, because that's a little more difficult, or were they just recording on their own?
They were recording on their own for the most part, but they would give me several different takes, and then I would choose the ones that worked best, or later in the story, Paulette was picking the takes. But if somebody recorded for me and they didn't come up with anything that really worked for me, then I would have them go back and I'd say, you know, you needs to be more like this. This is kind of the feel that I'm looking for, or these are the emotions that need to be implicit in that. And mm-hmm. then they would usually be able to get it to me right the next time.
It shows really that much more of an admirable job your actors have done, because it's not easy to record like that by yourself. You don't have other actors to hear to bounce off of, and you don't necessarily have that live direction of a director to really get that perfect take. So the fact that it came together so well is quite a testament.
Yeah, particularly when they had to go to some very intense emotional places. I'm thinking right now particularly about Christiana playing Fiona and the places that I had to have her go with that character.
She's here in the chat room too,
yes.
Right now.
So Christiana, I just want to publicly acknowledge you right now for the range that you brought to Fiona. That character absolutely needed somebody who could understand her and really handle the levels of emotional repression and then the level of release when that stuff came out. So, yeah, that you blew me away with that one. She says you made it easy for me. Everything was there on the page. Well, thank you. Glad that it really worked. And if I start going into all of the actors who did fantastic jobs for me with intense emotional scenes, we'll be here for an hour. So I just want to say you guys all rocked.
Yes, Justine in the chat room says to Christiani, you couldn't have rocked on that role harder if you were on Viagra.
Oh, no comment.
Oh, that's Patty.
Of course,
it's Patty.
Patty Heaney.
All right.
Well, stepping back a little bit from the actual production itself, as a writer, how did you become interested in the whole science fiction and fantasy genre? And what is so special to you about writing in this genre?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. Science fiction and fantasy, my parents started me out young. That was the stuff that they were into, and so that was the stuff that I was exposed to from a very young age. The stories that I mentioned earlier, you know, Mom was reading the Chronicles of Narnia and The Hobbit to us as soon as we could stand to sit and listen to them. And I think that you do pick up a lot from your parents in terms of the kinds of stories that they like to hear, and then you sort of develop your own tastes beyond that. They got me hooked on Star Wars at a very young age, Star Trek, watching the Star Trek movies. I can remember sitting and watching Classic Trek and with my dad. And I was raised by geeks, and they did right by me. so I think that was where I got started with my love of fantasy. And also another thing I have to say is Saturday morning cartoons. There's a lot of...
The Smurfs!
The Smurfs, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles...
Gummy Bears!
Transformers, Mask, Rescue Rangers. I mean...
Oh my God, that's right. You're young enough for Rescue Rangers.
I'm young enough for Rescue Rangers.
Wow.
Yep. G.I. Joe, yeah. I mean, there were... Oh!
DuckTales!
Tailspin was one of my favorites. I remember the Sky Pirate with the fridge accent. I love that character. One of these days I have to have a story that has a Sky Pirate, a steampunk Sky Pirate with a
and now play the French accent!
Exactly. I did not really watch Speed Racer. Thundercats! Yes, guest 15. Thundercats were awesome. Voltron was awesome. My mom used to watch Voltron with us. But, so there's a lot of spec fic in children's literature and children's entertainment.
Very true, yeah.
Thundercats, ho! I'm not old enough for Speed Racer. Well, it was on. It was just on reruns. Kimba the White Lion was also on when I was younger. But, as for why I love the genre, I think that one of the things that I came to appreciate about it once I was old enough that it wasn't just fun stories was the fact that you can tell just about any kind of story that you want to tell with speculative fiction, and you can explore angles of it and ramifications of it that you can't explore in mainstream fiction. Or at least if you can, you can't quite explore it as purely. Because when people come to events in the real world or things that have that real world flavor about them, they carry all of their projections and their preconceived notions about the real world into it.
Yeah.
So you can't have a conversation about, say, homosexuality without people carrying in all the preconceived notions that they have because of the way that they were raised. You take that same kind of story and you tell it with a fantastic spin. You put it in another world with another setting with a different kind of oppressed minority, or even with still dealing with the homosexuality issue, but you're dealing with it with fictional characters in a obviously fictional world setting. And it gives you a freedom to talk about the same kinds of issues and the same kinds of problems without having all of the cultural stuff getting in the way. And specfic has been really good for exploring those sorts of difficult topics that we have a hard time exploring honestly as a society, or exploring without our ingrained biases. You know, you think about the works of Heinlein, where he really was pushing the boundaries on what people thought was workable in terms of human social structures, or for that matter, in Moon is a Harsh Mistress, when he's exploring the American Revolution from a very cold-hearted, pragmatic point of view that doesn't get, trigger all of the
ideological choke-up points.
Yeah, exactly.
And the line marriages in that in that book,
line
too.
Line marriages, yep, and all the other interesting social structures he has there. And the fact that he was able to deal with a story that was like the American Revolution the way it probably happened, without having, triggering all of the patriotic programming that we have that makes us think it was a different way. So I will always love speculative fiction for its narrative power to explore controversial and interesting ideas, to do so in a way that is quote-unquote safe for mainstream people to think about, and hopefully will then be able to affect their thinking when they see the analogous situations in the real world.
You mentioned what influenced you as you grew up, but what influences you in the genre as a writer for writing Metamore City?
Current influences in terms of books and movies and such?
Well, it doesn't even have to be current, but obviously, you've grown since you were a kid watching some of those shows.
Oh, yeah, definitely. More recent influences, well, Heinlein is a big one. I'd say that he probably had more impact than any other single writer in terms of changing my thinking about what you could do with story and what you could do with human social structures. For characterization and dialogue, I'm going to go with Jim Butcher and Kim Harrison, two urban fantasy authors who I absolutely adore their books. And while each of them has their flaws, they're tremendously entertaining, and they write really great characters that are very engaging. And so I think I've learned a lot from reading about their stuff.
Christiana says, if you haven't read any John Varley, then you absolutely must. You'd love his stuff. And I've got to second that. My friend Mary was one of his beta readers for years, and so I've gotten to see a lot of Varley stuff.
Oh, cool.
He's fabulous, and he would really resonate with you.
Excellent. Yeah, I haven't read any Varley, so that's definitely one that I'll check out.
Check out the story Persistence of Vision. Heartbreaking. Gorgeous.
Cool. Interesting. Yeah, I'm racking my brain trying to think of who are the other authors who have really shaken me up recently. Richard K. Morgan did a series of books that began with Altered Carbon, a very, very dark, very gritty noir sci-fi. And one of the things that I learned from him, even though I don't really copy his style, is he takes violence very seriously. And his characters are absolutely brutal. The things that they do, he does not shy away from the consequences or the ramifications of them. And people have accused him of being too graphic and too bloodthirsty. And one of the things that he has said in his defense is violence is terrible. Violence is really, really bad. And we have this idea in Western civilization that you can just pull a gun and shoot somebody and solve the problem. You can get rid of evil by shooting and killing all the evil people.
Yes. Well, he confines it to Western civilization, but that's a human universal.
Yeah. And so his philosophy is that if you're going to have violent characters, you have to show how terrible that is and to show the consequences of that sort of approach to solving problems. And that was something that really, really stuck with me. And so I've, in recent years, as I've been plotting out stories for Metamore in particular, I've been thinking about that and thinking about the orgy of violence that pervades our culture and the belief in the idea that you can make a better world through killing people who are bad. And of course, the truth is that we are all a bit bad and a bit good, and there's light and darkness in all of us, and that you can't avoid that, and that violence tends to perpetuate violence. So, yeah, like Christiana said, like the operative from Serenity, he's approaching the world from that standpoint of, I can become a monster and kill all the evil people, then the world will be perfect. Well, no, it's not. And so that's been a huge influence on me as a writer. And I'm going to have to go ahead and say that Joss Whedon's Serenity has and Firefly have definitely shaped my thinking a lot recently as well. Yes, thank you, Guest 8, who says, yay, Firefly reference. But yeah, that whole thing of trying to go up against the culture of redemptive violence, that's the term that gets shuffled around in philosophy a lot, the idea that we can redeem the world through killing bad people. And it's a lie. It's one of the most destructive lies of our civilization. And it's one that I'm trying to fight in my own small ways by showing that there are some problems that you can't solve by killing people.
Mm-hmm. As a writer, how much of you personally is injected into the characters you create?
Oh, gosh. I think I'd probably need a therapist to sort that out.
This is one of those questions you're not supposed to answer. In professional distance.
In joke there. Yeah, I really don't...
Mad Marv says, just the sex.
Oh, gosh. There are bits and pieces of me all over the place, and I imagine that all of my characters probably embody me or different aspects of me to differing degrees. Obviously, I can point to some characters like Daniel or Will from The Muse who were really channeling a lot of me. And I was doing so consciously in a lot of cases. But each of the characters becomes their own person sooner or later. Novilla says we'll need a shop vac because there's bits of Chris all over the place. Yeah, I mean, all of the characters start out as pieces or aspects of me and then kind of grow in their own directions. I'm sort of like the seed crystal that they all develop from, and they all develop in different ways depending upon the basic pieces that I start with and the needs of the plot and how the character interacts with the other characters.
From the chat room, Chris's major viewpoint character was actually Victor. Don't let his kind demeanor fool you.
Thank you so much, Brian. I love you too.
But
Guest 22 says, I knew it.
Yes, I mean, as a writer... you got to draw from somewhere, so even if it's at an unconscious level, some of that character comes from your own self.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. Characters do ultimately come from inside us and from our own subconscious.
Or at least to write a believable character.
Yeah, yeah. And that's probably why I have difficulty with some characters more so than others, because those are parts of me that I'm less in tune with than the parts that... are embodied by people like Daniel, who I can really resonate with what's going on in his life. Like I said, it's one of those things that you'd probably need a therapist to sort out.
Well, and of course, there's also the characters that draw upon other people you've known rather than upon you so much.
That's true. And so, you know, I'll take bits and pieces of other people I know, and ultimately, of course, they're filtered through how I understand them. And so I need to know, you know, I have to be able to have some degree of empathy for where the other person is coming from so that even if I don't agree with their viewpoints, I can understand how they came to them. Mm-hmm. And so that is a source of additional raw material for making characters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Christiana added, where characters represent the thoughts and feelings and fears that you have. Yeah, definitely.
Even if it's only at an unconscious level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pip says characters are a nice way to safely explore all those different sides of yourself. And it's true. I think that's one of the main purposes of storytelling, is to allow not only the writer but also the listener to explore different ideas and different viewpoints and different emotions and ideas in a way that's safe. And
in fact, in a way that's called gestalt, which is a nice little tie-in for your world.
Yeah.
What exactly is the ritual you take? How is your environment when you're really getting in and writing?
Well, first the ritual starts with drawing a circle in salt, and then you have to... And then you have to call upon the muse by sacrificing a goat. And
that's where all my goats have been going. Damn you, I've been trying to make goat curry for weeks, and they all keep running away.
I'm bribing them.
Bastard! They're destined for Vindaloo, not for the goddess. We all make great sacrifices for our writing, don't we?
We do. Some of them are buddier than others.
But anyway, that aside, is there a certain, you know, drink or certain music? I always find that interesting, as every writer really seems to be different of how they approach it.
Generally speaking, I try to approach my writing sessions with a fresh cup of either coffee or tea. And I like to go to the bookstore, you know, like a Barnes & Noble or a Borders, and go to the cafe, get a drink, sit down, and plug into a wall jack if I can find one, and then just read through the last scene that I wrote, look for anything egregious that stands out that needs to be tweaked, look at my outline for what I have going for the next scene, and then start writing. I try not to have any music plugged in to my ears or anything, but pure silence is not quite the best environment for me either. Mm-hmm. I like bookstores and coffee shops because they have a little bit of outside stimulus to keep my brain interested and aware and keep me from just staring off into space. But there's nothing too obtrusive about it. So that seems to be the general scenario that works fairly well for me. Are we supposed to be taking shots every time Chris says egregious? I think he said it in every feedback show.
That's a good point. You say egregious almost as much as I say particularly.
The Metamore City drinking game.
Oh, just wait for the next feedback show. We actually had one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the next feedback show that you'll hear, well, we had a drinking game every time that one of us was called a bastard.
It was a long night.
I'm sure.
My typing speed is not very fast when I'm writing, Christiana. I can type very fast when I'm just taking dictation or whatever, and I can type pretty much as fast as the thoughts flow, but the thoughts don't flow too fast. I tend to be very... Actually, she says I was asking about Pip's sheep. Oh, the typing speed of the sheep. Okay.
Pip says, every time Dan says something dirty, take a drink, you'll all be drunk pretty quick. Yeah, that's one for you to say, Pip. Remember the sex show when you were here.
Or for that matter.
Erotic a la carte.
Or just about any other time when we were walking around with you. After 3 days of hanging with the Kiwi, my brain was stuck permanently in the gutter.
It hasn't gotten out yet.
No.
It shows in the new short stories he's writing for season two. Season two will be much racier.
You mentioned an outline. Do you really plan an outline and write from that, or is it more of a flowing, organic process?
It depends on whether I'm doing a short story or a novel. When I'm writing short stories, I'll usually have like a one-page summary of what the story is going to look like, and then I'll just go from that and write pretty spontaneously and see where it goes. For longer stories, I have to outline. I will start with a... Beck says, oh, so Pip corrupted Chris, not Dan.
And someone else said Dan started it.
Pip says, I feel my entire trip was worth it then. The world can thank me for sauce from Chris Lester. Or actually, it's just from Christ Lester. That's
Is that implying something?
He bleeds for his work.
Yes. The suffering servant for you.
But we won't get into that kink.
I am not touching
what
that.
What are we talking about again?
Talking about the process and outlining versus
organic. Oh, the process,
organic.
Yes. It's not so much organic. I tend to start with a one-page story summary and then break it down. First, I have to figure out what characters I need, and then I will flesh them out a bit, just put in some of their basic character traits and what they want, their motivations, basic personality traits, and how they tie in with the other characters. And then I'll start plotting. There's a number of tools that I've used. Most recently, I like Jim Butcher's technique that he suggests, which is that you plan out the story as a series of scenes, which are attempts by the viewpoint character to accomplish something, followed by sequels in which the character has failed to accomplish whatever it was that they were attempting, or they've accomplished it, but it's introduced new complications. And then they have to sort of sit back and say, okay, that didn't work, now what? And then come up with a new plan, which then leads into the next scene. And you can structure your whole story as that scene-sequel sort of process, and it keeps the story moving and keeps you introducing new complications to make the characters' lives more interesting. Within that, the larger viewpoint, you then take that scene-sequel structure and you plan for your beginning, of course, some sort of big middle, which is the point at which all of the dominoes are in place, and then you have one really big scene that is dramatic and intense and that starts the process of all the dominoes falling, which then leads to your climax and denouement, and where you tie everything up in the end. And it's in the last scene that the main viewpoint character finally gets what they wanted. Although I subverted that a little bit with making the cut, because in the final scene of the story, I switched and told it around from Victor's point of view. So even in the last scene, the character who we're seeing it from still isn't getting what he wanted, but he's the villain, so that's okay.
But it follows someone else's rule, which is always tell the story from the point of view of the person who has the most to lose.
Exactly. And that was definitely Victor in that case.
Evidently, the chat room has declared Christ Lester to be free from original sin, but not egregious sin. And Christiana Ellis wants to know how your whether your world building guides your plot, or whether you build the world to serve the needs of your story.
Great question.
Ooh, good question. I have to rewind now to when I originally started creating Metamore City. Metamore City originally, I created the world setting out of the projected consequences of a plot that I was working on in Metamore Keep about the fall of the gods to Earth. And so in that sense, the setting served the plot. But one thing that I found is that plot and world building build on each other, and that I go back and forth between having a world that inspires certain plots, which then change the shape of the world. When I started working with the Psy Collective, that was a nifty bit of world building that particularly fascinated me. There had been hints of telepathy and other psychic powers in Metamore Keep, but they weren't identified explicitly as being different from magic. And so I thought it would be interesting for those things to really come into their own in the 21st century or late 20th century of Metamore City, to then be able to explore the ramifications of that and kind of create what would a psychic society really look like. So that started out as sort of a fun mental experiment that I could play around with within this larger world that I had created. And then one of my commentators on the Writer's Wiki pointed out, this whole Psy Collective thing and all the stuff you've talked about conflict between Psys and mundanes, is really like this huge Chekhov's gun on the mantelpiece. And you should do something with that. You should make that a focus for the larger plot. And then we started talking about ways in which that could be done. It turned out that was the impetus for making the cut, and also set into place all of the pieces for the ongoing story arc. Well, not all the pieces, but it set into place some major pieces that are definitely going to crop up again, even as early as season 2, although it won't be immediately apparent how they fit together.
Having just finished season 1, you've done some short stories and a full-length novel. But aside from that, what else do you have to tell in this world beyond season two? How long can this go?
The story arc for Metamore City is 5 seasons. Good enough for Babylon 5. It's good enough for me. And
that's something.
So season two is going to set up more of the pieces, and you know, it's going to be a self-contained story in and of its own, but it's also going to put more of the plot points onto the mantelpiece for the later seasons. And then in season three...
we have the Uber nemesis!
A.T. You know, season three and four, things are really going to start to ramp up, and we're going to see some of the big consequences of those early plot points that I'm putting on the wall in seasons one and two. And in season five, it's going to all come crashing down in a apocalyptic end-of-the-world sort of scenario in which nothing will ever be the same again.
Very cool. Definitely an epic scale, seems like.
Yeah, it's the most ambitious thing that I've ever tried to write. So hopefully I stay alive long enough to finish it.
So we've touched on what's coming in season two, but that's the biggest question on everyone's mind. What's next? What's in store for everyone with Metamore City season two?
Well, in season two, it's gonna start off with several short stories. And in those short stories, you're going to see Abby Preston and Janus team up to try to track down a haunted violin that is leaving a trail of bodies across the Empire. You're going to see a story written by J. Daniel Sawyer, which is called Lies in the Dark.
And you're bringing him into this?
Yeah, imagine that.
Cool.
That guy's such a hack.
I know, he's such an asshole.
And that will be a story taking place. We're going to see the Metamore Empire space program, and it will be a locked room murder mystery set on the space station, the orbital mining facility at the L4 point, which is sort of at the end of an equilateral triangle between the Earth and the Moon.
That by itself is very interesting, having this world where you have magic and at the same time being in space, that's mm-hmm. something that you don't really see.
And it's going to be an important point because there are no natural mana springs up in space. So any magic that they have, they have to take with them, and it's extremely limited. So they can't just do an augury on the body to find out who killed this person. And so then it leads into more of a classic detective story, but they are on the clock because the life support systems depend upon the magic supply, which has mysteriously disappeared.
It's a double locked room mystery aboard a space station where there's no magic and many, many things hang in the balance and a ticking clock, and it'll be a lot of fun.
Yes. So you'll be able to look forward to that. You'll also see a audio drama, which is going to debut at Balticon, in which Ms. Fallon, the succubus from the Sentinel, has been arrested and is being detained by the Lightbringers for having supposedly murdered an angel child. And so Janus is trying to get to the bottom of that, and it's going to be a very Usual Suspects sort of story, which I'm looking forward to. You'll also see a story called Divide by Zero, which is about a brilliant young theoretical physicist down at the southern end of the Empire who has a mysterious encounter when she puts forward her latest research, which suggests that prophecy is impossible and that all of the people who've claimed to be prophets are basically either liars or deluded.
And that's a great story. I'm really looking forward to hearing that one produced.
Yeah, that one's going to be a lot of fun. And let's see, what else is on the turnpike for...
Nobilis' story.
Oh, yeah, Nobilis.
Nobilis
story.
Is in the chat room. We've got to plug his story.
Yeah, Nobilis is doing Dreams of Change, which is going to be a story taking place at Empire University and is going to show us some of the conflicts within the magical community between wizards and sorcerers. People who depend upon books for their magic versus people who have these sort of innate, spontaneous magical talents that they can't really refine or control as well. So the wizards tend to look down on them, even though sorcerers have more power. Planifolia by Brian Watson, in which Brian Summers is going to be teaming up with rookie cop Michael Pirelli, and they're going to be pursuing it appears to be a conspiracy by a group of Mundy extremists to wipe out preternaturals. So they're going to be trying to get to the bottom of that.
Someone said Metamore City 2 seems to be made up primarily of short stories. What's the deal? And the deal, ladies and gentlemen, is that Chris Lester is cheating. You see, 9909 is supposed to be when Philippa Ballantyne, Chris Lester, and myself debut the next novels in our series.
Mm-hmm.
We're all going to debut them on the same day, but Chris hasn't written the next novel in his series yet. He's planned it, and so he's cheating by having a bunch of other people write short stories for him to give him a buffer.
And I'm writing my own, I'm putting forward my
yeah,
own
Yeah, and you're story. Putting forward a couple of your own, too.
Yes. The centerpiece novel for season two is called Things Unseen. It is going to deal with lies and conspiracies around the noble elite of Metamore. You're going to see a couple of different problems. There's a group of people who are showing up. Their bodies appear to be burned from the inside out by magic. And so this involves Catherine Catane and her partner David Silverleaf working together to try to find out what is killing these people. And it leads them into a set of tangled relationships among the bright, young, decadent scions of the ruling noble houses. And along the way, they have to try to find a missing heiress. She's basically like a Paris Hilton type and constantly being in front of the paparazzi and causing all kinds of interesting mischief. She is a member of the hedonist universalist cult, which is run by the succubi and incubi, which, of course, is tremendously popular with the press, but not so popular with the ruling charge. And so she goes missing, and this ties into the ongoing investigation that Kate and David are taking part in. And basically, it looks like a group of young scions have come across a power source that is more than they can handle. And they are starting to show up dead. More interesting when Malcolm Ardvalos finds out about this and finds the source of that power for himself.
Dun, dun, dun.
Hey.
Reagan Fisher has been a bodyguard all of her professional life. She's confident, witty, beautiful, and she'll do anything to save someone from death. She caters to the wealthy, the powerful, and the social elite. She's their date. She's the party girl. She's the best friend. In other words, she's not what you think of when you think of a bodyguard. And she knows what she believes in. If you asked her today if she believed in the supernatural, she'd say no. If you asked her if she'd become embroiled in a strange murder, she'd say no. If you asked her if she believed that an old friend's discovery of a strange religious artifact would change her life and everything she knows about angels, magic, demons, and reality, she'd say no. But what if you told her that the price for not believing in these things is death? Guardians is the first podcast novel by Kimmy Alexander. Set to launch on May 22nd of 2009, the novel takes Reagan behind the curtain of what we know as reality, showing her that good and evil have been at war beneath our feet and above our heads all along. Join Reagan as she finds out they've always been with us. Go to www.guardiansnovel.com to subscribe to the podcast now.
We should go ahead and open up the chat room now.
My thoughts exactly.
Okay. Let's start out with the D. Morris says, I'm in the loop, baby. Go on, Lester. I dare you to take my call, you saucy bitch. All right, T, you're on the air.
Hello, you saucy bitch.
Okay.
You're way overdriven, T. Can you dial back the gain a bit?
Can I dial back the gain a bit? Of course. I'll just use my Christian Bale voice. How about that?
Part of the plan.
If I'm all part of the plan. Lester, I'm so gonna bitch slap you and spank you and make you call me Nancy. I swear to God, for raising the bar like you did with Metamore City. You thought I was pissed last year. Well, all I can say is thank God I do have one dibs. I finished Moravia Remastered before you prick. So, you know, I got that going for me, which is nice.
That's true. You did finish Moravia Remastered, even with the long hiatus in between.
There you go. Fair is fair. But I'm going to ask you, Chris, the same questions I asked Dan in his incredibly magnificent, if I do say so myself, incredibly magnificent exit interview. After all this has been all said and done, what are the lessons you walked away from this? What are the lessons that you look back and you said, I've taken this away from the experience the way you did the podcast?
Okay, let's see. Major lessons that I took away. One is...
Let's talk about me. Come on, let's talk about me, because it's all about me. Come on.
The picture right, of humility, so, ladies and gentlemen, here. The self-proclaimed uber nemesis, the self-proclaimed god of podcasting, one of the most humble men in the universe, T. Morris.
Oh, yes, thank you so much. Now, let me tell you about my day and how I got this beautiful MacBook Pro in front of me.
Be careful, T. Kitty's in the room here, and she's got a flogger on the wall waiting for you when you get here if you're not careful.
Dude, why do you think I'm talking like this? I'm talking smack so that Kim will put me in my place. Seriously, Chris, though, seriously, what did you learn from this experience?
I learned a lot of things. One is I learned the capabilities of my software, which is something that I wish I had known when I got into it. After hanging out with Dan and seeing what he was capable of doing with Antithesis, it really showed me the level to which you can push a lot of these Pro Tools-style programs and what you're really capable of accomplishing with them if you take the time to learn the tricks. So I wish I'd learned a little bit more about the technical capabilities of the programs that I was using before I started. I also wish that I had gotten in all of my actors' audio from the beginning and that I had actually listened to all of their audio before 2 weeks before it was due to come out on the podcast, because I did make some problems for myself there by going and finding out later that audio was either unusable or that they didn't really get the emotional resonance I was looking for in a particular scene. That's something I would go and do differently. The other thing, really make sure that you've got a solid production team behind you so that you're able to deal with the ongoing stresses of this kind of work.
You are a lucky bastard for that. You know that.
You're very unique in that respect and the podcasting space to actually have people helping you produce your audio book.
See, I was going to say he was a lazy bastard, but you guys are being a lot nicer than I am.
I want minions, T. I want to be able to offload some of that work for the next few books.
The more that you guys farm out the work, the more I'm going to be like, look, this is why I'm the uber nemesis. Nobody can keep up with me. So I'm okay with that if you guys want to do that.
Once you match the production level of Antithesis, then we can talk.
Oh,
I'm sorry, Dan Prick says what?
I have to agree with Dan on this one. I don't think there's anybody who's matching his level of production values on Antithesis.
Oh, yeah, of course. Billy Battings, Parsec Award, Parsec winner.
just you wait. I don't know if it'll happen this year, but it'll happen sometime.
Yeah. One of you, Lester. One of you. Up your ass. Up your ass. All right. So anyway. But I will ask you this though, Chris. Again, in all seriousness, being the guy that you have accredited for making you do Metamore City the way you wanted to do it. Here's my question to you. Would you do it any differently? Would you want to go on ahead and just do it bare bones, no special effects, or were you having as much fun as myself, Pip, Dan, and other people that have taken this route? Would you, if you were to go back and do Metamore City all over again, Metamore City Remastered, if you will, would you do it straight read, or now that you've had a taste of what we do, would you say, you know, I'll do it again this way?
I would never back away from doing this sort of story because I think that the cooperative aspects of it add so much to the experience. I mean, it is just a hell of a lot of fun.
Isn't it, though? Isn't it?
Yeah. So this is a huge blast. I love being able to collaborate with other people and make these stories together. That's just, it's a blast, and it's not something that I'd want to give up.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, from a personal experience where I felt like, yeah, this is why I do what I do, was when in Moravi, in the remastered version, I did that scene with you, T.G. Holyfield, and Scott Sigler. And you guys made that scene come alive. And at the end of it, I must have listened to that scene. It's only a tiny little scene. It's one of my favorite in the books. And I listened to that scene over and over and over again. And I just said to myself, this is why I'm doing it the way I'm doing it. I mean, I'm having a blast putting my friends into precarious situations and just having, I mean, you know, I would say you hit it. That was the answer I was looking for, that you were just having. The reason why we all do what we do isn't because we want to show off. Okay, maybe with me, it's because I want to show off. But with all of us, I think it's because we are having as much fun. I mean, Pip has even said she scaled back Weatherchild, but she's itching to get more people involved. And she claims that she's going to bring her A game for Digital Magic. I don't know. Do you think she's got it? Because you know, I think she's just talking smack. I mean, it's easy to talk smack from 7,000 miles away. You know, that's what I think.
I think that you're just you're angling to get another whipping there. And you say you're not a sub.
Yeah. Like I said, I am the better half. I am the better half of the Ava Aven. You never gave me a seductive, saucy dance to do. So, you know, there it is. You know, I mean, you know, if you'd given me a dance club scene, people would have seen how saucy I am. So there you go. I still think you're a saucy bitch, though, Lester.
People are going to see how saucy you are in book two, because in Things Unseen, guess who Malcolm Ardvalo sends to try to sweet talk information out of Morgan Drowling?
Oh, that's going to be fun.
Yeah. No. Yeah. No. You mean,
well, people are going to see how saucy you are in Down from 10, too, man. You're just going to be sauced all over the place.
And now I'm thinking that somewhere between tonight and tomorrow I have to record my erotica a la carte. Which reminds me, Dan Sawyer, you're a pussy. You're a pussy because you didn't bother to read your erotica a la carte.
I'm not going to be able to maintain a female voice for that long, man.
I don't care. You pushed out. I have to say some extremely naughty things in my erotica a la carte, and you're dead to me, Sawyer. You're dead to me until I arrive in San Francisco and need a place to stay.
If it'll make you feel better, I'll read you mine out loud in person.
Only as a bedtime story. You beautiful, beautiful man, you.
Okay, we're
done here.
Yeah, I'm gonna mute. T. Morris, you are muted.
You are muted. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Thank you, T. All right, let's see who else we've got here. Okay, let's go ahead and take this one, Mr. Dubs. Brian, you are live.
Master Lester.
Salutations. How are you doing, bro?
I am doing well. How have you been?
Oh, you know, ups and downs, but getting through it, and we're almost to the end of the semester, and just having a lot of fun today.
Yeah, well, we're missing you up here. Sarah and I were talking about you today, so.
Yeah, where's Sarah?
She's at work right now, man. You know, if you'd have put this on Pacific time, she could have called in, but no, somebody's got to go on Easter.
Yeah, unfortunately. I wanted to try to aim the time at when as many people from as many time zones as possible could be here.
Yeah, well, one thing I got to say from the both of us, and I know we both left you something, is we were both very humbled and thankful for your dedication of the story to us. You moved me to tears, man, which is not easy. I usually just stand there and look kind of stony-faced. But
do you get those big, wide puppy dog eyes, and then your lips purse up, and it's so cute?
Yeah, well, because I'd already read a good portion of the book. I said, you know, I am not going to start listening until there's only like 3 or 4 episodes left of making the cut. So I started about 2 weeks ago and would not listen to anything else in the car the entire time. And I got to tell you, you know, I have listened to a lot of podcast novels now, and none of them have made me do that. So, you know, the other thing I wanted to bring up is I really did, though, like the conflict there that's just been brewing between the mundanes and the size. And I've been wondering just how much of it the average mundane is really aware of.
Yeah, not very much. From the perspective of your average Joe mundane on the street, the size are kind of like this odd little religious brotherhood or something. They're kind of like, you know, the Masonic Lodge or the, I'm not going to say the Scientologists because they don't try to bilk money out of people. But
right, and then they'll also probably try to sue you too, so.
Right, yeah. But they're this group of people that there are some really wild, crazy conspiracy theories about that you can find on the bizarre little corners of the world net, but you can't actually hang on a minute. Ladies and gentlemen, we are getting a live call from Paul Fisher.
Here, use my put it on the speaker, use my mic.
All right. Can you hear us, Paul?
Yes, I can hear you.
Paul, you are live on the Metamore City exit interview. How the hell are you?
I'm damn fine. How the hell are you, Chris?
Confused. And I'm not going to tell you that I'm in the corner macrameing with my pubic hair.
Despite the fact that you have the propensity for inspiring that behavior in people, evidently.
Is it long enough to do that?
Steve Moore has talked about doing that when you called him on my, this is Dan Sawyer, on my exit interview.
Is that my job to call during other people's exit interviews?
Apparently so.
Wow,
what can I do for you, Paul,
I had no idea I was doing it either time, although it was mentioned to me today that your exit interview was today.
Well, you're not only calling during the exit interview, you're being held up to one of the microphones.
Oh,
this is technology at its finest.
Cool.
You are on the internet.
So, do you have a question for Chris Lester in the exit interview, as long as you're here?
Oh, yes, I'm sure that I do. I'm really, really sure that I do. How much training do you have to go through, and do you need to file your nails when you thrust your fingers into my chest and rip my heart out?
How am I ripping your heart out, Paul?
You killed the baby.
Oh, Darla. Yes.
Hey, he should have known that was coming.
Who's that?
That's Steve Rickyberg.
No, that was Brian.
Oh, that was Brian? Can't keep track.
Yes, Brian.
If he was listening to the short stories, he should have known it was coming.
I listened to all the short stories. I just, you know, have a day job, so I forget these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we knew what happened to Darla in Troubled Minds, and then in Making the Cut, we saw how it happened. So, yes.
Oh!
Kind of adds a creepy edge to the...
Some people thought that Making the Cut referred to Danny, or Daniel getting turned into Danny. But,
Oh!
That's not funny, man.
Not cool.
So, yeah, no special training other than watching Joss Whedon shows.
Okay. Watching Joss Whedon, that's really good training for the ripping out of said heart.
Oh, and George R. R. Martin books.
And Indiana Jones.
I never liked of Doom.
Oh, that was a horrible movie.
I'm with you on that, Paul. Sorry, Indiana Jim, if you're listening.
I think even Indiana Jim might admit that was a bad movie.
No, he won't.
Still says the fourth one was a good movie, and that was a bad movie.
I'm not going to say it was a good movie, but I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed the second one.
Okay. All right, Paul, anything else before we let you go?
Well, I had something else having to do with the bandwidth on my server running out, but I can talk to you about that tomorrow.
Okay, cool. Yeah, we'll take care of that offline.
Okay.
All right, take it easy, Paul.
Talk to you later, Chris. Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, so I'm going to put my phone on mute now.
Now I don't feel quite so bad with mine ringing a little earlier.
The joys of live audio.
Indeed.
You guys didn't think ahead for this. I'm really disappointed.
It's a busy weekend.
Although, given the odd synchronicity that Dan's show and mine have carried out through their entire run,
it's very appropriate.
It's very appropriate that both of our exit interviews are interrupted by Paul Fisher.
And contain the phrase, macrame my pubic hair.
I never want to hear that again.
Steer clear of T. Morris. It's evidently his hobby.
Yeah, well, speaking of which, I thought I told you never to call Chris a saucy bitch again, okay? I am sending you the therapy bill for that shit. Anyway, Chris, the point I was trying to get to here was, you know, you're building this up, and you've said yourself, you've told me, that the Psy Collective is definitely a way for you to explore socialism and communism. Mm-hmm. And what you're basically setting up here...
And also the philosophies of the evangelical church.
This is, okay. But, you know, you're basically setting up it up here as kind of like the Cold War, only the U.S. doesn't know it's in the Cold War. You know, there's the mundanes. They've got no idea what the hell's coming.
That would be much more analogous to the Red Revolution in Bolshevik Russia. The Crown didn't know what was coming, but the Bolshies were gathering forces.
The thing to understand about the Psy Collective is that they are basically isolationists. You know, they would prefer to just be left alone. And to, you know, live their lives in the shadows of mundane society until they gradually replace the mundanes. But they don't expect that to happen. They expect that sooner or later, that with them outbreeding the general populace by an extravagant rate, that sooner or later they're going to be numerous enough that the mundies are going to notice them and that they're going to get scared. And when that happens, they want to make sure that they're in position to take control of society for everyone's good, and thus prevent any further bloodshed. They want to win the war before it starts.
Well, gosh, and that idea scares me.
Yeah, as it should. And, you know, they don't want to kill anybody. They want to destroy the vampires because they consider them to be an abomination and a perversion of telepathic power, and because the vampires are the biggest threat to their ongoing plans of basically taking over controls of mortal society. Right now, the vampires control a lot of things from behind the scenes, and the telepaths want to be controlling those things, not out of any malice towards the mundanes, but from their perspective, it's like taking a gun out of the hands of a child. They want to remove the ability of the mundanes to hurt them or to hurt themselves.
The telepaths need to learn. They don't need to take over the businesses. They don't need to take over the news. They just need to take over the entertainment networks and the stupid masses will just conform because that's what's on their TV show.
Well, and imagine the marketing edge they'd have. They'd know what the people want.
That's true. That's very true.
Seriously, how do you write these ads?
Yeah, Brian, the latest feedback show in which I mentioned this isn't out yet, but since you're on the line, I wanted to give you deep and sincere compliments on your vocal acting versatility. It's quite impressive.
Oh, when did I do that?
Artax, Brian, that scene you had playing opposite yourself, it was great.
Yeah, I have actually expressly forbidden Chris to actually put Artax and Brian Summers in the same room. He is not allowed to do it. They're not allowed to have phone conversations where, you know, you hear both voices. It's just not going to happen. And if he does it, I will come out there and kick his pasty ass. It's just going to happen.
You better watch the references to my ass, Brian. We get enough jokes about man love on this show already.
Particularly involving Brian and Daniel Sharabi.
The bromance isn't over just because you moved away, dude.
Yeah, but he's in San Francisco now.
No, Bill.
That's the
tasty.
Thing.
Tasty, not tasty.
In Shelby Township, Washington, you know, Michigan, if, you know, we get comments like that, everybody looks at us weird. If I go out to San Diego, that's San Francisco, wherever the hell you are, I don't know.
There's
not
a big difference between San Diego and San Francisco.
Dude, you just bought a Big Mac at Burger King.
You know what it is? It's not here where we are. That's what I'm noticing. So it's, you know, we're all still, like I said, we're very sad that we don't have you to talk about. And that was actually what we kind of know. Sarah and I were talking that we think that Dan and Kitty are your new usses, and we're not really sure how to. You realize that, Dan? He's just going to move away from you and make you cry. So
that's okay. I have a long reach.
Okay, and you were saying about the bromance stuff.
You and Sarah are going to have to come out and visit one of these days.
We are.
People in the chat room are now calling for Artax Brian / Greg. And Nobilis says that Artax would just change Brian into a woman.
Is Pip still there? Pip, could you write some / for us along those lines? That would be great. I'll record it, and then I'll sneak it onto Chris's feed when he accidentally leaves himself logged in.
I can tell you that I won't actually record the audio for it, okay? I don't know.
That's okay. I'll just listen to a lot of your voice and imitate it.
All righty. Anything else for you, me, bro, before you get going or before I meet you?
I think that's it. I'd have Heather say hi to you, but she's all sick right now.
Okay. Yeah, one of these days I have to actually meet Heather.
Yeah, I know. It's weird. I'm actually dating a woman. I never, you know. Apparently she says she's liked me a long time, but I don't get it. I think she's fibbing.
Well, you know, there's this whole wonderful thing that I've discovered since moving out here. It's called self-esteem.
I've heard of that, but I tried to buy some. They said it wasn't good enough for it, so I was...
Oh. Oh, sheepers, dude. You're a hell of a voice actor, if nothing else.
Well, I appreciate it.
Heather, if you're listening to this, just give him a good solid kiss for us so that he knows that he actually is worth it. But
no.
Goodness knows I'm not going to do it myself.
I really appreciate that.
Besides, his lips aren't that long.
So I will continue voicing characters and being curmudgeon-y as Artax for whatever you need, Chris.
Excellent. And, dude, call me once in a while, okay?
You know, I should do that.
You should. You really should.
Right. I switched over to a GoPhone, and now I have to pay 25 cents a minute, and it's a pain in the butt.
Ouch.
Yeah, well, you know, I barely use it anyway anymore, so.
Well, there's this wonderful thing called Skype.
There is that thing.
Yes.
All righty. I'm going to go ahead and mute you now, bro. Talk to you later.
All right. Talk to you, dude.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay. Let's see. Who else have we got in the chat room here? How about Nobilis? You're on.
Yep, I'm here. Hello, gentlemen.
Oh, dude. Hey.
How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
Can you speak up a little? We're pretty faint there.
Is that better?
That's much better.
Much.
Yeah, I was using a headset on my phone. So I just wanted to say Metamore City just blew me away the last few episodes there. My wife, who is standing here in the same room with me, has not listened to all of them, and so she's got her hands over her ears and she's shouting at the top of her lungs. I'm going to find another place to be. Hold on. Will not be spoiled. Will not be spoiled. So the I don't know if the I may not be up to date on all the feedback stuff, but did you get my feedback from the very last episode?
Oh yeah, I did, and it's going to go out in the last voicemail show that I still have not edited yet.
So I won't recapitulate that then. But oh man, I am the king of feedback voicemails. So I could not miss this event.
Yes, you are.
Yes.
Indeed, indeed.
And great brevity and wit in them, too.
Well, thank you. I try. Because it's a lot easier to get a one-word feedback into the show, you know, than some long, rambling, semi-coherent rant.
That's
and,
true.
You know, sometimes that's all it takes, you know.
Uh-huh.
It's just, dude. You know?
Although I seem to recall that you had at least a couple of those long, rambling rants earlier in the season.
Well, you know, I had more intellectual content and less emotional content early on.
Uh-huh.
By the time the story was half to three-quarters done, most of the logical inconsistencies were either papered over or no longer mattered. And and I could just roll along and enjoy the, as Paul put it, having my heart ripped out of my chest on a regular basis.
Yeah, I'm so glad that I was able to get that emotional engagement from people because, to me, that's the most important part of storytelling. If you don't care about the characters, what the hell is the point?
Yeah, I mean, that's something I'm still learning is how to really not feel bad when I destroy characters in front of the eyes of hundreds or thousands of people and they enjoy it.
Well, I feel bad. I mean, you think it didn't hurt to kill Sasha? I mean, golly, that was agonizing. She was one of my favorite characters.
Oh, I know, but it's what it is that there's an enjoyment to witnessing that kind of drama that is not pleasant, but it's important. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think the old Greek idea of catharsis.
Mm-hmm. No, it's wonderful.
Things is played out in front of you. There's a value to it and a pleasure to it that, you know, that isn't a laughing, happy pleasure, you know. And mm-hmm. I'm still learning about that. And,
yeah. It was as much as it hurt to put her through that whole experience, the scene when Fiona and Sasha said their goodbyes.
Oh, that was gorgeous.
Was one of my favorite scenes that I've ever written.
I don't know if I mentioned it before, but I noticed that there was, with Fiona's character especially, this, and I don't know if this was on purpose, but it certainly came across that way. There's a scene in one of the first chapters where Fiona has been trapped and the MacGuffin has been taken from her, and she's just furious and frustrated, and she's failed, and there's an emotional scene there where the facade cracks, and you see that Fiona is capable of this deep emotional outburst.
Mm-hmm.
And Christiana did a great job on that, and then that kind of passed, and she got herself back together again, because mm-hmm. it wasn't really a completely destructive breakdown. It was, you know, a crack. And then later on, and I'm being exiled. And then at the end, when we see Fiona's true like reconstitution
mm-hmm.
as a character, that scene becomes, oh yeah, there's a real passionate person inside there. You know, and that scene in the beginning was necessary to that realization at the end. Was that on purpose or just it happen?
It was definitely on purpose to show Fiona's emotional breakdown early on, because I needed to show that she was cold, not because she was, well, actually she is a lot like a Vulcan. I was going to say that she's not, but she is, because the Vulcans shut down their emotions because they're too intense for them to deal with. And that's a lot like what Fiona did, that she had all this stuff bottled up in her that she had no way how to process. And it was partly because she'd had her memories taken away from her, so she didn't have the context to be able to. But, yeah, I needed to show that this was a woman who did not know how to feel. She felt so intensely that it disabled her. And rather than learning how to process that like a human being, she shut it down and turned to her logical mind. Fiona's character was really inspired a lot by a very dear friend of mine who I got to know in college, who, when I knew her at first, she was very rational, very calm and collected, and emotionally reserved. And we got to have some great intellectual conversations and became lab partners because she thought that I was the only person in the room who she could count on not to screw up her experiments for her. And so we got to be very good friends. And then later on, she went through some personal life-changing stuff where the facade broke and she opened up emotionally and was totally unprepared for what was inside herself. And she would literally, you know, show up on my doorstep at 2 a.m. crying because she needed somebody to hold her. And, you know, this is a very smart, competent woman who just did not have the tools to deal with the stuff that was inside her. And it was years before she worked through to develop the kinds of coping mechanisms that allowed her to be able to feel and to be in touch with all of herself and express all of herself and still be a balanced human being. And Fiona's story is really inspired by that friendship.
Hmm. And it goes back to that original thing about either it comes from yourself or it comes from someone you know.
Yeah, definitely. And she is my soul sister. We are close in the way that I'm close to very few other people, and I think she knows me on a level deeper than anyone else knows me, including my own family. So that sort of character arc is a story that's very near and dear to my heart, and Fiona's journey was a way for me to express that.
I'd like to put out a call at this point. I didn't do it because I don't feel really up to it, but I want to see more of Fiona.
Mm.
I want to see how she deals with...
I think you just spoiled her, Nobilis.
No. Okay. I'm not going to say anything that's going to spoil my life, but I want to see how Fiona deals with the new situation more. I don't know if it takes more of a short story or whatever, but you know, the change is so close to the end of the book that we really don't see a lot of the new Fiona.
Yeah.
So just
dangling threads, Chris, dangling threads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, I didn't do it with the story that I wrote because I like playing with other people's settings, but I don't like playing with their characters. I feel like I'll break them. But I'd like to see more stories that talk about Fiona. She's a fascinating character.
Yeah, we'll definitely see more of the Summer Cell down the line, including Fiona. And I would like to do a short story that would kind of do maybe even just a vignette that focused more on Fiona and Abby's relationship now that Abby contains all that is left of Sasha in this world.
Right, right, right.
And that would be a really neat story to tell. I don't currently have a plot for it, but it's one of those things that I'd like to explore. And I also want to explore how Daniel is coping with the guilt over killing Victor, because Victor was his mentor and companion for years, and
yeah.
So that cost him on a level that we only see hinted at in Making the Cut.
I mean, the characters are so deep in this story that you could almost do a short story on each of them after this. You know, it's not like Brian hasn't got his story going, too, and everybody else. Been kind of on my mind as I kind of, like, oh, I'm not listening to Metamore City anymore. Now what am I going to do?
Yeah. Well, Nobilis, I'm going to let you go for now because I've got some other people I want to quickly get to before the end of the call. But thanks so much for calling in.
You're welcome.
All right. And let's go ahead and go to
Christiana.
Author of the just released in print, Nina Kimberly the Merciless.
Nina Kimberly the Merciless.
Hey, Christiana.
Is it working now? Is it working
it
now?
It is.
Yay. All right. Good. I'm glad. I'm also just, you know, really glad to hear so many people talking about Fiona because, you know, even aside from the opportunity to play her, I really enjoyed the character too. You know, I am not Fiona, but at the same time, I was really able to identify with her a lot, I think. And just the opportunity to play her really meant a lot to me and stretched me both emotionally and dramatically in a number of fun ways. Or fun is maybe not the right word. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Useful, valuable. Yes.
You did a hell of a job.
Well, thank you.
Yeah,
I remember the first time the breakdown back in the early chapter, my initial inclination was that you weren't going to actually, you know, essentially you weren't going to play for audio the actual sobbing. You were just going to do that with the narration. But you said, no, I really want you to do it. And so, you know, that left me first with a little bit of a challenge of saying, okay, well, how do I do that without having my neighbors call the police? The answer apparently was to do it during the day on Sunday in my laundry room.
Mm.
Anyway. But, you know, just working up to that and that sort of thing, that sort of real, you know, this screaming and sobbing and stuff like that was never something I had ever had to do for any performance before. And so it was really a new challenge for me, but one that I really am glad that I did. And so thank you for the opportunity to play such an interesting character.
Well, you're very welcome.
And, of course, if you do write more about her, I would be happy to return as the voice.
Awesome. Yeah, I definitely want to return to Fee again in the future. And I look forward to hearing you continue to voice her growth as a person, because she's a cool character and you've done a great job of bringing her to life.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed reading the book. And, in fact, during the recording sessions, I was hesitant to read ahead because even though obviously I had to read ahead to know what my lines were going to be so that I could record them and send them, there was this feeling that I had of like wanting to wait until I could hear it in the audio to know what was going to happen. I didn't want to spoil myself. And I occasionally managed to do that by, you know, searching and finding my scenes, but trying to avoid the scenes that she wasn't in. I did that for a couple of times, but most of the time it wasn't practical to do that. But I did manage to not spoil myself that Miriam, well, okay, I guess everyone listening now knows, right? But that Miriam got turned. And so I didn't get that tidbit until it happened in the audio. And I was like, oh my God, I totally didn't see that coming. Not only did I just like not see it coming at all, but I was just like, I was horrified and enthralled at the same time. It was an intense scene, not just in the sense of the action, but just in the horrifying implications of what it would mean for Miriam to be turned. And then there's so much great stuff to do with that subplot. And then of course, because I play Fiona, I was just thinking ahead of saying, dude, Fiona's not going to be happy with this.
Yeah, it's her hero and her idol.
One thing I thought you were maybe going to do a little bit more with was just Fiona's whole bit about being helpless contrasted with the vampire's compulsion thing. You know, the hypnosis and so on. I thought you were maybe going to do a little bit more with that than you did. Now, what you did was still awesome. It was just different than what I was expecting. But there's just so much depth in your story and the world and the characters that you've created. It raises all sorts of implications, and then you get to choose which ones you want to use.
Yeah, thank you. You're going to continue to see the contrast between the Psy Collective's egalitarian, we're all in this together, we're all equals viewpoint, and the vampire's very dominant, submissive, hierarchical worldview, because they're two very different ideas about how the world should be structured, and those competing visions are going to continue to clash with each other in future seasons.
I did have one other question for you that's kind of it's a non sequitur here, but given all the different kinds of, you know, races and types and, you know, that you got the humans who have the curse and you've got the Psy Collective with their different powers and you've got the vampires and all the different characters, if you had to be a citizen of Metamore, what would you choose? I don't mean like
question.
Which character. I mean, what type of
job?
Well, or job, or just like, you know, for example, would you be a member of the Psy Collective with this power? Would you be, you know, a human has chosen this curse or what?
Good question. While I like a lot of the things about the Psy Collective and I think that their powers are pretty freaking cool, I think that they carry way too much cultural baggage that I wouldn't want to deal with. So I'm not sure that I could actually handle being a part of the Psy Collective. I think that I might like the idea of being, you know, a really low-level Psy like Jared is, where you can get some of the benefits of the emotional bonding and transfer of thoughts and feelings during physical intimacy without having to deal with all of the cultural crap that the collective has to deal with. Because personally, I like my independence rather a lot. If I were going to take the curse, I would definitely take the androgyne curse, just because I've wondered about the male-female divide for years and have been very interested in exploring all sides of it, as you can probably tell from my
I was going to say, it doesn't show at all, man.
Yeah, not at all. But yeah, probably that. I think that I would probably enjoy working as a, you know, I think that being a thaumatologist would be interesting, doing work with magic on the theoretical level, maybe at Empire University. That would be cool.
Cool. That's, yeah, that's actually, I was just laughing because that's almost kind of what Nobilis said in the chat room is he guessed that you were going to be an androgyne wizard. So.
Yeah, androgyne wizard. That's a good guess there, Nobilis. All righty.
I didn't really have anything else, but I just wanted to thank you again for casting me, and I really enjoyed it and enjoyed the story as a listener as well.
Well, thank you, Christiana. It was a real pleasure to have you in the show, and I'll talk to you at Balticon.
All right.
All right. See you then.
See you then.
Okay, and I only have time here for one more call.
Kim going to call in?
Yeah, I think Kim was going to call in. Let's see. There she is. So.
But she's not online.
Well, she's here. So let's try this. Kim,
Kim!
Hey!
I've been here the whole time, but since my internet connection is down, I can't see the chat. I couldn't let you know that I can't see the chat, and I can't tweet because I'm on my cell phone.
Okay. Well, Beck happily passed on the news. So,
welcome to our madness.
I like your madness. Actually, I don't think, have I ever spoken to you before?
No, this is the first.
I was thinking that to myself earlier. I'm like, wow, I know exactly what they sound like, but I've never spoken to them.
It's true. That is one of the weird things that I experienced when I went to Balticon the first time, was like, I know all these people's voices and I know their faces, but we've never actually met.
Yeah.
Oh, since what I went to Dragon Con before I started really listening, I know what everybody looks like. It's just no one remembers me.
So, you got a question for us?
Oh, man.
No.
I you know what? You spoke for an hour after the last time I asked a question. I don't know if I dare.
Well, we won't have time for that now because we've got to wrap up the call in just a few minutes. But yeah, if you've got any brief questions or
snarky comments.
Go ahead and let it rip.
I hadn't thought that far. It's just horrible. And everybody, I mean, we've had a pretty good overview to just today of your creative process and what you like about your world. Is there any special like story element that you wished you could have fit into the story that you couldn't, that you're not planning on using the later elements of line? I mean, are there cut scenes from Metamorph?
Ooh, good question. There are some interesting little corners of the world that I wish I could do more with. I'd like to be able to show you guys more of like what's going on with the immortals, the fallen deities of the pantheon, and what they're up to and the games that they play with human lives during their very long lifespans. I'd like to do more exploration of the dragons' culture because they're an interesting breed. There's this whole network of civilizations down in the Southlands who are basically being dominated by mega corporations, and it's a very noir tech, cyberpunky sort of feel. And I really can't get into very much of it because they don't have that much to do with the overall ongoing plot. So, yeah, I mean, there's little pockets of story all over the world of Metamorph that I wish I could delve into in greater detail, and I'm just having to pick and choose.
Let me see. Oh, see, you know, it just the sort of thing that always happens when I'm put on the spot and I don't have anything planned. let me see. Now, I just wanted to let you know that when I picked up and listened to Avedon Hill and talk to you guys online, I was like, I really, really have to listen to this podcast. And so I started listening, and I listened to this. I listened to The Huntress. I'm sitting there, and I'm like, oh, dude, I would kill to play this part.
Oh, how cool. And you're all playing the part next time, right?
Yes.
Rock on.
Nice.
Yeah, so I went from I would kill to play this part to, hey, will you audition to play the backup for this part?
So, Chris, who died for this? Who did she kill?
Well, I have, you know, I guess it would have to be Leanne, but...
Oh.
Rocks and small woodland creatures, it's all right.
I was going to say, is this where my other goats have been going?
All righty. Got anything else for us, Kim?
No, you guys rock. See you at BoltzCon.
Thank you.
Yeah, I can't wait to meet you in person and hear that song that you've been working on for me.
I can't wait to do that cover of Hallelujah with you. We got to get working on that.
Oh, yeah.
I got too much stuff going on, but
yeah,
I
you and me both.
You guys, because you rock.
You rock, too.
All right. Talk to you later, Kim. Thanks for calling in. Okay.
Right.
And that is all that we have time for today, ladies and gents. For those of you who have been sitting and waiting in the chat room, I apologize, but Artistic Whispers Studio is booked at 7, so I need to be clearing out of here so that Dan and Kitty can get done the stuff that they need to get done tonight.
Gotta put this thing to bed.
Gotta put it to bed. Steve, where can people find you?
Geekcred.net is pretty much it.
All right. And Dan, where can people find your stuff?
JDSawyer.net.
And, of course, you probably know this already, but you can find my stuff at metamorcity.com, chrislester.org, and I am Etherius on Twitter, Etherius, just like it says in the chat room. And I want to thank everybody for coming out for this group discussion. This has been a huge blast, and I'm so pleased to see so many people here following along.
A lot of fun.
All righty. Well, this will do it, Metamorphs. This is the last little tidbit for Metamore City Season 1. Those of you going to Balticon will get your taste of Season 2 there. And stay tuned to the feed for the summer story interregnum. I'm going to continue taking story submissions through the end of this month. I'll announce the winner sometime in June. And until next time, keep it on the bright side. Chris Lester, signing out.
Some of the music on this show is provided by the Podshow PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. Some sound effects were provided by SoundSnap at soundsnap.com, while others were provided by the Freesound Project, located at freesound.iua.upf.edu. Metamore City is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.